Welcome to the Quintessential Podcast, and thanks to our new title sponsor, Spire Academy Lacrosse. Spire is an international high school and post-grad sports performance training and education boarding school located within a world-class event and wellness complex. Welcome to the Quintessential Podcast. It's still early March, joined this week by Bill Tierney, former coach at Denver and Princeton, who won 7 NCAA championships, recently retired. Coach, you worked the Denver Cornell game. What was it like to be upstairs and not down on the sidelines?
it's different, especially especially in that kind of atmosphere. It was really crazy, and it was one of those things. And I was fortunate this past summer to work with you for one PLL weekend, and with Ryan one PLL weekend, of course, with Cotter as well. And it was so much fun. But the difference with this one is I caught myself, or other people caught me, kind of trying to coach it from inside the booth. And I trying to get Brownie to call a timeout during the Cornell game. And obviously he's not hearing me, and wisely so. It was a great atmosphere, the Cornell team, and it was phenomenal. And and the Denver team just kept battling back. Cornell was up 4 goals twice, and Denver kept battling back. The place was rocking and sold out and noisy, and it was a great experience. And for me personally, it was good to be up there and know that I slept a lot better the night before than I would have had I been involved in that game.
And you sleep better after most games as well.
Exactly, because that's usually the bad night, is the one after the games, you know.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned that tendency to want to coach. I still feel it with my friends who are coaching around the country, like, and my friends who broadcast games. I have to really discipline myself. I've got a problem with texting Kark or Cotter or Anish during a game, like, or even feeling like reaching out to a coach and sending him a text at halftime, like, why aren't you inverting more? Or when are you going to go cover number 28? And I really have to discipline myself not to interfere. That's how strong sometimes the feeling is.
There's no doubt about it. And it's, as you know, it's much easier from the booth than it is from the sideline. As I told Brownie, the Pioneers are 4-0 right now. And if I was coaching, they'd be at the best 2-2, but it's one of those things you have. I've if I want to continue doing this thing which I do, I just got to make sure that I continue to stay as neutral as possible and do the best I can with the people I work with.
Yes. So you're retired. I know your resume really well, obviously, but like, this has got to be the first spring you've had since the late 60s without a team. Is that accurate?
Yeah. In the spring of 1969, I played my last high school baseball game. And then the spring of 1970 was my first lacrosse game when I was a freshman at Cortland. So it's been 53 years. And, I was, when I hung up my playing shoes, that was pretty easy because I wasn't that good a player. But this coaching thing is, when you do it this long, 50 years of coaching, 49 in lacrosse, from high school to Division III to an assistant, at Hopkins with you there, and then to Princeton and then Denver. It's just been such a blessed journey. And but as they say, you know when you know, and I knew, and it was the right time, and I'm at peace and really happy with my life right now.
You know, it's interesting for me. I started coaching my daughter's high school team recently, helping out. And, I was kind of thinking about it like, oh, this is where I belong. This is where I can be helpful. For you, this spring's got to be a little different. It's the first, as you said, in 50 years. There's got to be positives with that, though. More time with your family, more time with your, like, when you balance, what are some things that stand out in terms of this pretty radical change in your life?
Yeah, the viewing from afar with the game, it's very easy. My oldest daughter, Courtney, just finished her basketball season in New Jersey, and She took her Hillsborough High School team further than they've ever gone. And my son Brendan is coaching his 8-year-old son and 12-year-old daughter in lacrosse and soccer and things. And Trevor, as you know, as you know, I got a little baby and they live here in Colorado. And then Brian, my youngest daughter, is the head women's coach at Kent State. So we were actually out there out in Ohio this past weekend. And I can tell you, it's, you know, when you coach, you're so involved with it. You know, it, being a part of the game is just, you know, you don't worry about the clock. You don't worry about things. But I can tell you, my daughter's two games this past weekend, I can't do it. I can't watch them. It's so you know, frustrating at times. It's so exciting at times, but it's really stressful. And so that's been different. I've been working with a lot of groups. I'm working with USA Lacrosse on the selection committees of the sixes, the under 20, and the men's national team. I'm on the IMLCA. I just retired from being their president, but those guys created a new position. You know, I forget what they call it, but it's basically keeping me involved with the IMLCA. I work with another group, SPKN, that's a coaching, you know, national coaching group, and now getting some feelers about working with the World Organization and things like that. You know, I did, as I said, I did the PLL games with you guys, which was so much fun. So, and I'm writing my book. And so that takes 3-4 hours a day as well. So it's, they tell you when you retire, you're going to be more busy. You doubt it, you know, you're not sure. For the first time in 5 years, I bought a ski pass. So I try to go skiing, you know, once a week, and I walk 4 miles a day, and you know, go to church if I can every day, and so the days are full. It's just different full of not worrying about, is an 18-year-old going to drop a pass in overtime.
the book project, we've talked offline about the book project. Tell folks about, like, whose idea was it? Are you just regurgitating stories right now that are going to be crafted into a book? You know, explain the status of this project.
Yeah, it's interesting. I for years, people have said to me, when you get all done with this, you should write a book about all these stories. I remember going back with, you know, these great coaches that I was affiliated with, you know, Tony Seaman, Dave Cottle, Richie Moran, Jack Emmer, all as I looked up to these guys, they had these amazing stories. So over the years, people have said to me, oh, you should write this down, or you know, when you get done, you should do a book. And so one of the, in my prelude in the book, and God knows it'll be edited down, but what I wrote was that I woke up on January 1st of last year, knowing that week I was going to announce my retirement. And I was reading somewhere about New Year's resolutions. And, you know, it had the same old stuff about, you know, drinking and smoking and being a better person. But one said you should write. And so I started jotting down that week and what that was like, and then skipped all the way through the season, and then just got to it and just started writing from my first memory all the way through. And as people have asked me in the last few weeks, how's it going? And, you know, what I tell them is, well, the good news is I'm 130 pages in. The bad news is I'm at 1985.
Do you find this is skewing towards coaching or relationships or characters or the sport in general? Or historical, what's front of mind for you?
Yeah, it's scary. All of the above a little bit. When I started out, I kind of thought of it as in three pillars. You know, one was just kind of growing up in Levittown, and which is very similar to where you grew up in Lynbrook, where in with the baby boomers. You know, for instance, on my street, we had 20 houses and 42 kids between, you know, 5 and 15. And so it was just a glorious, amazing place to grow up. You learned how to play everything. You learned how to, you know, come in the house at a certain time because all the dads were the same. You learned that you could go into anybody's house and have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And if you didn't clean up, you learned that that kid's father had your father's permission to smack you upside the head, you know, and you learned so many things in that environment. So I thought that was important. And I had such great youth coaches, whether it was youth football, basketball, baseball, you know, that inspired me, that how much they influenced me. And then certainly going to high school at Levittown Memorial, where Nick Bolitzis and Phil Wolf were just my idols. And I saw how they could impact people. You know, ninth grade, I got cut from the basketball team. And within 30 seconds, Phil Wolf's monster hands were on my shoulder and says, "You have a wrestling match tomorrow." And so, you know, all those things. So it was kind of three pillars. One was the growing up in Levittown part. The second was my playing part, which started in 1970, as I mentioned. And of the three, that was the shortest. But all the way through 1983 or so before I went to Hopkins, where I was playing box lacrosse. I played in a precursor to the NLL in 74 and 75 with box lacrosse. And then the coaching part. And the interesting part is I sent Christian Swayze, who wrote a great book about Coach Moran and you know, the Cornell teams called We Showed Baltimore. And he asked me to do the prelude to that whole thing, which is kind of the forward, which was kind of funny. But Christian, I asked him to read my first 10 pages. And he said, "Coach, this is interesting, but two things. Your 10 pages will be cut down to one or two. And people just want to hear about your coaching and lacrosse side of it." So I ignored him and started writing all the way timeline right through. And as I said, I'm at 1985 now. I actually watched the film of your freshman year when we upset Cornell in the championship game. And you go back in time and see that. First of all, you played a phenomenal game. And second of all, the difference in the game of lacrosse between now and then is ridiculous.
Dave Hallen, my roommate, who was on that team, texted me recently. He had watched the semifinals from that year, and he said, "Wow, we were in great shape because the ball was on the ground the whole game. And it was just this pack of what appears to be like rec league lacrosse by today's standards. But with the stick technology, the ball was just, it was more accessible for the defense."
No question. And then, you know, 1997, when the offset heads came out, everybody dove to them. It reminds me of that story I wrote in my book in 1971, when the plastic sticks came out and you ran from Cortland to Ithaca to buy a plastic stick at Cullen's Sporting Goods. That changed the game. And then you go to 97, where everybody tried using these offset heads, but a lot of guys couldn't because they were so used to the no pocket things. I remember on our team at Princeton, Lorne Smith was the only guy I let use it because he was such a stick expert, you know? So you're right. You look at the sticks now, guys are popping the ball around. The passes in that game were like, had arcs on them, but it was still great lacrosse and great competition.
Funny you mentioned Lorne, because Lorne scored on me in the summer of 97 in Vail on an extra man from the top left corner, his spot, from 16 or 17. And at that stage, I knew it was time to retire. There was a one shot. He beat me from outside. And I'm like, I did not see that. Where did that come from? It had a different whip. I'm like, that's it. I'm done with goalie. And I was obviously not friendly to the new technology. With your regurgitating of these old stories, like, I don't remember much until somebody needles at it, or I see a box score, or I see a photo, and then my memory opens up, and it's incredible sometimes. Like, I can remember field conditions, I can remember specific plays, I can remember sounds, but it needs to be stirred by somebody. How are you regurgitating, or how are you opening up your mind to what happened in the 70s and the 80s?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's funny, I'm starting to feel how how getting old can be. You know, there are days where I wake up and can't remember yesterday, but then going back to, you know, like I just finished, you know, writing about my first fall at Hopkins as the soccer coach. the story about Zim working the clock, and it becomes the clarity just becomes jumps right out to you. But what stirs that, and one thing I've noticed is that if you and I, who shared that 1987 championship, if we went back and tried to remember that game per se, we would each have a total different memory of that. And as you said, what, you know, you might say something to me like, hey, I intercepted that long pass, you know, and I hadn't remembered that. All I remembered, well, I remembered a lot about those games, but, you know, all I remembered generally about that weekend was Freddie Smith and all those stories. So that clicks into my brain. And so, but, you know, Ray Rostand, who was my best friend in college, to this day is my, you know, godfather, one of my children, best men in each other's wedding. Ray and I have talked an awful lot about, and I called on him about our playing experience together, because neither one of us played in high school. We started this thing on a freshman team at Cortland and got our way through and pro lacrosse and all that stuff. And it's funny to hear someone else's memory of something. When we were sophomores, we played at Adelphi, and it was an all-out bench-clearing brawl. And Ray remembers that he saved me from two Adelphi guys being on top of me. And I remember it from me yelling at him to put his helmet back on because some guy was swinging a 6-foot wooden stick at his head. So, you know, you have this conflict and these cooperative stories that just make your story's better. You know, you want to incorporate other people's views and things they say, but you also, if people are interested, then they want to hear your story as you go.
Yeah, they're gonna ruffle the brain cells though. Also, they're gonna awaken you. Oh yeah, I forgot about that. You mentioned Bill Belichick, who had ties to Navy, a team you played in 1973, I think, or 72 in an NCAA tournament game, correct?
Yeah, in 1972, Cortland was, to this day, the only, there was no, they were called Division One and small schools back then. It wasn't Division One, Division Three, Two, Division Three, but akin to Division Three, Cortland was the only team to ever be in the Division One tournament. And that came via beating Army and beating Cornell during the year. And so we were invited to the tournament, actually, felt, you know, the bumper stickers at Cortland in 70, fall of 71 and spring of 72 were called Avenge the Screw in 72, because we felt like in 71 we could have done that. But anyway, turns out that our opening game was at Navy, in Navy Marine Corps Stadium. And Coach Belichick was a sophomore at Wesleyan at the time. His dad was a football coach at the Naval Academy. So I learned from somebody that Coach Belichick might have been at that game. And so, you know, Coach and I have, you know, developed a nice relationship, you know. And so it was during this whole madness of the New England Patriots, you know, he was going through, you know, a month, month and a half ago. And I'd sent him a text, just offhand, maybe he would answer it. And within a half hour, I'm on the phone with Coach Belichick in between this madness of the Patriots. And he was still so angry about the fact that Navy was up a goal with a minute left in the game. And they were man up, and one of their players took a shot. And our goalie, Peter Graham, saved it, ran over the midline with it, thinking of you, watching you last night. And we took a timeout. We scored the tying goal. And then one of the things Coach Belichick talked about the Navy defensemen in those days is that, you know, he just called them great athletes, great football players who couldn't catch and throw. And interestingly enough, in the overtime, they made a save. They got the ball. One of their defensemen picked it up and was running down the field. Oftentimes they would run down the field with one hand on their stick and the ball, you know, as we call pee on a knife, you know, and Paul Wareham.
Pizza flip.
Yeah, exactly. Paul Wareham knocked it out of his stick and Bert Severn's got the ball, was wide, had a one-on-one with the goalie, and we won. And so, you know, that, but Coach Belichick was still emotional about that. He goes, I can't believe that the guy shot the ball with 1 minute left and man up. You know, he's still kind of angry about it.
Today's episode is brought to you in partnership with Spire Lacrosse. Spire's world-class high school and post-grad lacrosse programs are ideal for serious lacrosse players looking for an intense training environment to prepare for the next level of competition. The academies provide student athletes the chance to study, train, and compete in world-class athletic and academic facilities while seeking the best possible college scholarship opportunities. He's got a special brain, Coach. And so does Paul Wareham. I sat with Coach Wareham. I told you at Larry Glenn's Hall of Fame induction. And Coach Wareham was pulling stories from the 70s and 80s and games, the most specific. And I was just amazed at his recall. Just incredible.
Yeah, Paul was a, first of all, he's one of the toughest college athletes I ever saw. I watched him play football. He played football and lacrosse at Cortland. He had a hip pointer that the bruise went from his knee up to his armpit, and he's playing football. But Paul and I, when he became my assistant for the 98 World Team, he said to me one night, he goes, boy, things have changed. You know, back in the 70s, I let you carry my bag, and here I am, your assistant coach now. I said, well, I hope you do as good a job as an assistant coach as you did letting me carry your bags, you know. So he's a great guy with as you said, a great memory. And he has given me some of those stories that I, you know, put in my writing so far.
Was he the last attackman to use a longer than 40-inch shaft that you've seen?
Yeah, I think there might have been somebody who used a little longer, but Paul's story, you know, at Cortland, when you were a freshman, you got handed a stick. It was a wooden stick, and the freshman coach gave him, he said, you're tall and thin, you're going to be a defenseman, and he handed him a defensive stick. He said, no, I'm going to be an attackman. He said, no, you're going to be a defenseman. So what Paul would do would go into one-on-one drills and alternate covering a guy and then being an attackman with the guy. And then we had these three phenomenal other attackmen, Bert Severns, Kenny McEwen, and Johnny Eberns. They knew it was basically like an alley-oop to Shaq, you know, with a 5'5" guy covering him. And he would score more goals going over a goalie's head and then down his back almost than anything you've ever seen. He would never dodge anybody, but he scored hundreds of goals just quick sticking balls in with that wooden stick.
This weekend, it's a little light on the TV side because of college basketball, but some games on ESPN Plus, Holy Cross Army, Navy Lehigh, Duke Loyola, Hopkins Syracuse at 6:30 on Saturday from Charlotte, North Carolina. When I bring up Hopkins Syracuse in your time at Johns Hopkins, what jumps out at you in terms of that rivalry?
Well, you know, it was so fierce, you know, sudden, like, even as you said, that sudden things, you know, jump in my head in 87, I think we lost to them at home in the opener, and the rivalry was kind of already in place because Syracuse had won that 83 championship with that crazy game that Hopkins was way ahead. And so that rivalry was born. The next year when we went up to the Carrier Dome, we had a manager named Georgie Poehler who at the time, Georgie was probably in his late 70s or so. And when you go into the Carrier Dome, it's air pressurized. So you have to go in, you know, they have to open a gate and close the doors behind you, or you can go in with a rotating door. And Georgie, he was a gruff old guy, and he tried to push the rotating door and got his thumb caught in the door and cut off half his thumb. Just before the game was to start, Zim looks at me, he goes, have you seen Georgie? I said, no, I have no idea. But Georgie came back at halftime with this bandage over his thumb, cursing that he had missed half the game. He lost half his thumb. But, you know, certainly that Syracuse rivalry. And when I was offered the job at at Hopkins. I was still at RIT. It was in March of 1984. And Zim asked me to go scout Syracuse before any of the games started. It was an 8-team tournament, and you kind of knew Syracuse and Hopkins were going to end up at the end. And I went and scouted Syracuse twice in the dome, which was kind of funny because as the RIT coach, and then they flew me down for a meeting, and I walked into a room and there was 9 or 10 other coaches in the room, and they had all gone to Hopkins, and I was so uneducated to lacrosse at the time. Joe Cowan said to me, do they still run spaghetti? I said, what's spaghetti? So Joe looks at Zim and says, you hired a guy who doesn't know what spaghetti is. So it's just all these great, great stories, but certainly the Syracuse rivalry and then the one we developed at Princeton in the 90s just continued that on.
Ivy League play starts the following week with some really good games initially. I think there's a Sunday game. Princeton is on television. When I look at this early season, Coach, three teams really stand out to me in terms of success they've had. Army, Johns Hopkins has had a strong start, and obviously the Denver Pioneers. And the three share, they bring back tons of production from last year. So, you know, Army is basically the same team plus the guys who are injured. Johns Hopkins, it's the same team plus some 50 years and transfers. Denver, as you know, what, 98 or 100% of their production? So it's really not surprising. And I think that's given them a head start. When you look at the month of March, from your standpoint as a coach, what stands out in terms of this month, whether it be the end of conference play, roster development, improvement, like everyone's searching for it to take that next step?
Yeah, I think if you look and the one of the big games this weekend is Yale at Denver, which is going to be a beauty on Sunday as well. But I think what happens in March is, in quotes, you're done fooling around. If you watch a lot of those February games, guys were subbing guys in. I watched Cornell must have played 5 short sticks, 4 poles, and of course their attack was intact and their defense was intact and their goalie was intact. But watching guys run on and off the field that you kind of look at and go, where'd he come from? Or wow, that's the 10th midfielder they're playing. And as important as those games are, because we all know in lacrosse that a game on February 1st is equal to a game on May 15th. And when it comes to selection for the NCAA tournament. So, but I, now that March has turned, hopefully the weather's a little bit better. You're starting to watch the solid lineups come to fruition. You're also seeing some injuries. And so how much those coaches played those guys in those important games in February is going to either have some guys who have been on the field now sitting on the bench, or some guys who thankfully were on the field because somebody maybe got hurt and now they fill in with some experience, especially some of these young guys.
Last thing I want to finish up with is a coaching question. It feels like now kids, high school players, even college players have lofty expectations. Everyone wants to be really good. I'm not sure all of them understand the work that it takes in this game, just the time with your stick, whether it was against the wall at Levittown High School, whether it was doing extra running when you were a pro. How do you communicate the importance? The work ethic has to equal the expectations.
I think, it's when I think about this, I wish that lacrosse had the wherewithal to kind of redshirt guys as freshmen and then not have to have them pay as fifth year guys. Now, with COVID, we're seeing the tail end of the fifth year guys, hopefully, or the number of fifth year guys. But because I think freshmen come in, and now more than ever, have no idea. You played as a freshman, but you had to win that job. It wasn't
just half the year. I didn't play till the end of March.
Right.
I sat on the bench 5 games. And that first game, I remember up in the dome at Syracuse, I was ready to go. That was the best warm-up of my life. But I know now that had I played in that game, we probably may have won. but we wouldn't have won the national championship because I was not ready to deal with the success or failure that was coming my way. And I didn't, you know, it wasn't a team thing. Like,
you got to let
things grow at the appropriate pace.
Yeah, and I think one of the great things about lacrosse, and you mentioned it on the air this past weekend, is where kids are coming from. You know, all the states, you know, at Denver, Coach Brown and I, over the last 15 years, we've had kids from 35 different states. But what goes hand in hand with that, with the Long Island, Baltimore, Philly hotbed, so to speak, is kids come out of high school with a little bit more competitive. They've been coached by guys who are college All-Americans and all that stuff. And so they have a little bit more lacrosse IQ. A lot of these kids that come from these other areas are really talented athletes, really great kids, care so much about the game. They've got an old school, mentality about the game, but they've been such superstars on their teams and oftentimes have played on teams that have no competition or very little competition. And then you combine that with the negative side of summer tournaments where they're playing five games in 2 days, basically can't hard to be coached and just, you know, the success being based on how many goals they scored. All of a sudden they get to college with somebody who's coaching them, whether it's offense, defense, face off. And it's a whole new world. And so I think nowadays it's a bigger challenge, not so much knowing that, hey, I'm a freshman, I've got a junior or senior in front of me, and I just got to wait my time or work really hard and beat them out. It's now, I've got guys in front of me. There's 50 or 60 guys on the roster. They all want the job, and the gap between their abilities and what they have to get to compete in some of those February games is just too big for those kids to be overly successful early in their careers.
I lied. I got one more. So when you're in your heyday at Princeton and you're building, like, how do you get better this week? Was it targeting areas of improvement, working on your clearing, working on your shooting? Was it more personnel development? Like, we need more shorties. Let's get shorty 3 and 4 more comfortable with the defense. Or was it more individual? Like, we've got to be better dodgers. We've got to be able to cover guys from Syracuse one-on-one. Or was it all of that? Like, the steady climb. I think the challenge is to improve just a little each week and to not peak and to always have maybe a little more.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And you know, as you know, I've been blessed over my career, 35 of those 41 years or 42 years of being in division, in college lacrosse, 35 of those years, I had Matt Brown and David Metzbauer as my assistant. So, I never got into, unless it was something that it was really noticeable, I very rarely got into the individual side. That was their job. They would take guys out before practice, work on their shooting, work on their dodging, work on their defending and stuff like that. The story I always tell about at Princeton was when my son Brendan played on a team, which he graduated in 2002. One of his jobs was to tell Coach Metzbauer when I was coming down to the offensive end, because they knew that Brendan was the only guy who could talk me out of a 3-hour practice or say to me, tell Metzy, here he comes, let's just do something normal, those were things that happened. But those guys were just phenomenal assistant coaches. But going back, I think in those 90s years, when you think of the Bacigalupo, Kevin Lowe, Scott Reinhart type days, David Morrow, and then you move into the Hubbard, Hess, and Massey group, and then the Trevor Tierney, Ryan Mollett, Ryan Boyle, Sean Hartoflis. As you moved through those things, you had guys that had such passion for the game. Now we have to bring in speakers to tell our teams about how important culture is. Well, culture is created by the players. You can nudge them along, but when Jesse Hubbard and Chris Massey and John Hess, they were such lacrosse geeks that even in their room, which they shared, or their apartment, which they shared, they had fiddlesticks. They were always screwing around with fiddlesticks and little balls. At Princeton, we had a place called the Pit, where it was kind of an outdoor basement where you could turn the lights on until midnight, because the campus police loved that guys were shooting lacrosse balls as opposed to creating havoc on Nassau Street, you know. And Kevin Lowe with his dad, Alan, you know, he was just such a student of the game. And obviously what Batch did, you know, for us to help us move forward in those championships and win a couple, it was just more of that. So we were enhancing passion. We were listening to players a lot more than people might think, watching my act on the sideline. But, some great advice from young men and some sacrifice. Lawrence Smith could have been one of the best attackmen to ever play lacrosse, and he played midfield for 3 of his 4 years, you know. So it was all, as you mentioned, all of the above. Every once in a while, we had a 29-game winning streak, and then got to Virginia one day, and they just kicked the living crap out of us. And we needed that. You know, we needed that to regroup. One time we played Syracuse at home, and we called it the Easter Day Massacre. Trevor and Brendan were playing, and we played, we had agreed to Coach Desco and I had agreed to play Penn and Cornell on the Saturday, and then play each other on the Sunday. And we didn't realize that Sunday was Easter. And they came to Princeton at that point, and they just, I think it was 16-4 or something. So, all these things combined really help those groups just know that they were going to win and were willing to take on other roles. We were losing to Duke in 98, and I had to put Trevor in the game as a freshman. And at halftime, we were still down, and John Hess, who was a feeder, said, just give me the ball. And he scored like the first 3 goals of the second half, which he never did, you know. So it was all these little things that happened that made guys run the team. And all we did was really coordinate.
Interesting. Recruit great players, but really target the guys who love it. As you were going to get to practice early and stay late. I don't envy your editor, Coach. I don't envy your editor, because just in this 35-minute call, you've given us so much good stuff. I'm going to be very fascinated to see what they like and what they're probably going to come back to you and say, I need more here. This is really good. And they're going to say, this is not resonating so hot. Hey, I love this story. I want to hear. And so I'm fascinated. I think the rewrite process is going to be really cool.
It's going to be different right now. My editor is my son Brendan's wife Annie up in Oregon, and Annie teaches 7th grade English. And so she edits every time I get done with 10 pages, I send it to her, and she edits it, because the things I'm the worst at are parentheses and commas. You know, it's like I put them in where they shouldn't be. I don't put them in where they should be. So after the first couple of ones, I said, I called her and I said, Annie, if I'm in your 7th grade English class, what do I have so far? She goes, she goes, you're working on a C-, but I see it's getting better. So she does the pre-edit. There's some apps online that are not AI. I'm not looking for anybody to write this stuff, but more of similar things, give you different ideas on how to construct a sentence and things like that. So it's quite a process, but it's been a lot of fun, and calling other people and sharing their stories. And I'll be calling you soon, because I'm almost at 87. It has just been a pure joy.
Well, thank you, Coach. Always love listening to those stories, especially ones that, when you're reaching back and getting some of that new material, it's just amazing. It's just amazing. Good luck with your TV work. We got Yale, Denver this weekend. I know Syracuse Hopkins again is a 6:30 game on Saturday on ESPN+. That's live from Charlotte. Clark and Anisha have that call. I'm heading to Tulsa, the Big 12 Wrestling Championships on Sunday night on ESPN2. So I get a week off from lacrosse and get to go back to my roots.
I love when you do wrestling because the guys come off and you know, it wrestlers aren't used to that. And here they're sweating. They just want a big game. And all they want to do is hug somebody, you know? Right. So
it's just not me when you're sweating. Sweat. don't hug me when you're sweaty. No, I, you know, I have this and then 2 weeks, the NCAA tournament, which, you know, to me, it's the most, and I find it to be inspiring. I come back every year and I'm just ready to go. You know, those young men are so impressive. Their work ethic, their respect for each other, their respect for competition. It's only been a huge positive and a blessing to be able to cover that.
Yeah. And, you know, as a wrestler, the thing wrestling does for you is, and I wrote about this in my high school thing, is what it does for you is, you know, it's a team, there's a team score, but you also know, like I won the New Hyde Park tournament as a senior and, you know, who knows who was there, right? But it doesn't matter. I remember that, walking off that. And then one time, you remember Seaford used to have a great wrestling yeah. team. And when I was a senior, our team lost 45-3, and I was the only one to win my match. So I get on the bus and everybody's heads down because you cared so much. And I was like, had to put my head down with a smile on my face because I beat a guy who had beaten me before, you know. But if anything, you know, I look back and getting cut from that ninth grade basketball team and being in that wrestling room then that day and then wrestling in a match the next day, I think it brought a little bit more strength and courage out in me that I knew I had.
Accountability, owning it. You know, people will always say, oh, well, it's the most nervous you were for a lacrosse game. I'm like, well, it doesn't compare to when we used to wrestle Southside or Valley Stream on a Friday night in front of all right. my friends, family in this gym with a spotlight. That's a, and oh, you're the only God. One out there, like giving yeah. up a goal. No, I would laugh at giving up goals.
yeah, no, it's and then you get to the level I'm sure you were at with the counties and the sectional meets and all that stuff is just crazy. Yeah.
Good education in terms of how to handle that kind of stuff. No, well, thank question. You, Coach. Great to see you.
Thanks.
Good buddy. Luck on the book.
Yeah, thanks. We'll see. And I think
over the year, I'll be checking in this spring.
Yeah, thanks. I think I got color on a radio broadcast this weekend, so we'll see. Great.
Well, that'll be a fun one. Yale gets up and down the field pretty good.
All right, bud. Thanks, Quinn.
Thanks, Coach. Thank you for tuning into today's show. You can contact me at quint.kesnick@espn.com with any feedback or guest ideas. And a special thank you to all our sponsors, including today's presenting sponsor, Spire Lacrosse.